There is a passage in the Pali Canon where Venerable Sariputta says all the footprints of all the animals on earth could be fit into the footprint of an elephant. In the same way, all the Buddhist teachings, all dharmas can be fit into the Four Noble Truths. I want you to keep that image in mind for as we talk about today's topic, which is the relationship of the Four Noble Truths and the Three Characteristics. Years back, I was listening to a dharma talk by a scholarly monk in Bangkok about a meditation teacher he'd heard who taught that right view was seeing things in terms of the three characteristics. He said, no, that's not true. Right view is the Four Noble Truths. And when I listened to the talk, I said, this is awfully pedantic. It's kind of a scholarly issue, but not really a real issue in life. But then the more I've lived with these teachings, the more I've begun to realize that it really is an issue. Which is more important? Which is the container? The question is, which is the container for the other? Do the three characteristics contain the Four Noble Truths, or the Four Noble Truths contain the three characteristics? Because this will change the meaning of the teaching. Which one is actually the giver of meaning, and which one has to fit into the meaning of the other? And when you look at the canon, it's very clear that the Buddha places the Four Noble Truths as the container. It's one of the few teachings that he said is categorical. In other words, true across the board for everybody at all times. When he gave his own descriptions of awakening, it was in terms of the Four Noble Truths and not in terms of the three characteristics. And when he began teaching, he taught the Four Noble Truths first, the first sermon, second sermon, three characteristics. So the Four Noble Truths for him were the container. After all, he said at some other point that all he taught was suffering and the end of suffering. And for a little footnote, those are two things, not one thing. You probably hear it said, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. It's not one, it's two. Ask anybody in a hospital. And the Four Noble Truths basically expand on this point, and it basically comes down to the question of how you desire and how you act in the context of knowing that there is suffering and that there is a path. Your actions make a difference between whether you suffer and whether you don't suffer. So the teaching of the Four Noble Truths takes on the assumption, okay, you want happiness and you're willing to act on it. Act on that desire and you want to act skillfully. At another point, the Buddha said, the beginning of wisdom is when you ask the question of a reliable person, what when I do it will lead to long-term welfare and happiness? And the wisdom there comes in, one, seeing that there is such a thing as long-term happiness. Two, long-term is better than short-term. And then three, it's going to depend on your actions. So actions form the context of what he's talking about. Now, actions, of course, are based on desire. And this is why the Four Noble Truths focus on two kinds of desire. There's the craving that leads to suffering, and then there's the desire as a part of right effort, a part of right resolve that actually leads to the end of suffering. So basically what you want in here and what the Four Noble Truths are giving you are ways to sort through your desires to see which desires are going to be helpful and which ones are not, which ones are skillful and which ones are not. Now, in terms of the Four Noble Truths, each of the truths has a duty. The duty with regard to suffering is to comprehend it, and that means understanding it to the point where you have dispassion for it. And we don't usually think that we're passionate for our suffering, but you look at people doing a lot of stupid things in life, and they want to do them, and they're going to suffer. So we are passionate many times for the things that actually cause us to suffer or constitute our suffering. The duty with regard to the cause of suffering is to abandon it. The duty with regard to the cessation of suffering is to realize it, and you do that by developing the path, which is the Fourth Noble Truth. Now, within this context of the duties with regard to the truths, these are truths, as I said, that guide action, that give you some direction onto how you sort through your desires as to which ones to follow and which ones not to and what to do. The three characteristics fit into this context. But first, it's important to note that the Buddha never called them three characteristics. Inconstancy, stress, not self, sometimes it's called impermanence, suffering, and not self. The Buddha never describes these as characteristics. He always describes them as perceptions. These are labels that you apply to things in your experience. And in the context of the duties of the Four Noble Truths, they actually help you develop some dispassion for the various things that cause you to suffer. One of these perceptions, the perception of not self, is not the perception that there is no self. The Buddha is basically asking you to pass judgment. If something is going to cause you suffering, if it's stressful, if it's changing all the time, is it worth calling yourself? Is it worth claiming as you or yours? And it's basically a value judgment. It's basically saying, no, not in this case. I don't need to identify with this. And so when you look at suffering, one of the ways of getting past your passion for suffering is learn how to perceive the things that that you're clinging to. As the Buddha said, clinging is the suffering. The things that you're clinging to are not worth it. Why is that? Because they're unreliable. Inconstant is my preferred translation for that, because impermanence doesn't really get to the heart of the matter. I mean, you can build a house on a mountain and say, well, the mountain is impermanent, but it doesn't matter to me because I can still build my house there. I trust that the mountain's going to stay. Unless, of course, it's a mountain in California. But you figure out, long enough for me to live and be happy, and I don't care about what's going to happen down the line, you know, in a couple of eons. Whereas if you say that something is inconstant, it's like trying to sit comfortably on a chair where the legs are uneven. You have to sit very carefully and not get too relaxed, because otherwise the chair may tip over. I think that's what the Buddha is pointing at, is one, and the term, the Pali term, anicca, does come from the term nicca, which means constant. And secondly, is you can't depend on these things to be there for you all the time. And if you can't depend on it, is it stressful or is it easeful? It's stressful. If it's undependable, if it's stressful, why claim it as yourself? And so the things that you would cling to, the things that you would hold to, the things that you might crave, these are the things you want to see. I don't really get anything out of these things. I've misunderstood my relationship to them. I thought they were worth the effort that went into it. Now that I can see it's not worth the effort. So you apply that perception both to the suffering and to the causes of suffering. Now as for the path, that's something different. The path is something you have to do. In order to do it, it's based on desire. You have to want to follow the path to the end of suffering. And you need passion there. So for the time being, you don't apply these three perceptions to the path itself. You apply them to anything else that would pull you away. For instance, in the case of virtue, the Buddha says at one point there are five losses that can come to us: loss of health, loss of wealth, loss of relatives, loss of right view, and loss of virtue. And he says of those five, the first three are not all that serious: health, wealth, relatives. You can lose them and still maintain your virtue. You can still maintain your right view. And that's your real possession, because you can maintain those things all the way through life and even on into subsequent lives. But so many times it's because of our concern about losing wealth or losing our health or losing our relatives that we might want to steal or lie, do something dishonest, do something against the precepts. And so the Buddha says in that case you have to regard these things with the three perceptions, to develop a sense of dispassion for them, so you don't cling to them so tightly, so you are willing to hold to the precepts rather than holding on to things that would pull you away from the precepts. Similarly with concentration. When you're getting the mind concentrated, you don't just watch it get concentrated and say, oh, it arises, passes away, and that's insight. It's more, once it comes, that's something you've got to develop. So when the concentration comes, you maintain it. You're trying to create a state of mind that is constant, that is easeful, and is under your control. In other words, you're fighting against those three perceptions at that point. You're trying to find something that you can really rely on. As you get more skilled in the concentration, learn that you can rely on it, then it's easier to look at the other things around you that you've been holding on to and say, well, you know, I don't really need to hold on to these things so much. They're causing me trouble. They're causing me stress. Maybe it's worth letting go. So you're applying to the three perceptions to things that would pull you off the path, but you don't apply them yet to the path itself. It's only when the concentration has done its work, the discernment has done its work, its virtue has done its work, that's when you develop dispassion for them too, because after all, they are fabricated, they're based on desire. And we let go of those, then if your mind is at the right point, now letting go doesn't mean you go back to being unvirtuous or unconcentrated, but you find that there's another alternative, which is when the mind opens to the deathless, which is the cessation of suffering. At that point, you let the path go. The traditional image in the canon is the image of the raft. You take the raft across the river. Once you get to the other shore, you let the raft go. You don't carry it on your head as you continue to travel. But in the meantime, before you get to the other shore, you've got to hold on. The Thai Jhans give lots of images for this. One is of being a carpenter working on a piece of furniture. And while you're working on the furniture, you've got to hold on to your tools. When the furniture is done, you can put the tools down. So you hold on to the path. You don't apply the three perceptions to the path until it's totally done its work. And that's when you say, this still is something that's fabricated. I want to go to something that's unfabricated. And that's when you let it go. So that's the way in which The Four Noble Truths form the context for how you apply what the Buddha would call the three perceptions. Now, however, these teachings morphed as they got into the commentaries. And there's a question of why it happened. One theory is that there were these debates that were being held in ancient India. A king would come into power. He would say, I'd like to hear all the different religions in my kingdom debate a particular topic that I find interesting. And the Buddha had warned the monks, say, don't get involved in these debates. Because after all, once the king sets a question, you can't say, that's a stupid question. But, you know, the Buddha, when he was teaching, he would often say, people would come up with certain questions, and he would say, no, this is a question that's not worth answering. Because he was in the position of control there, and he was able to control which questions got asked and which questions didn't get asked. And as for a question that he wouldn't answer, he'd also give a reason for why it was not worth answering. So, for example, the question, is there a self, is there no self? That's a question he put aside. However, that was a question that the kings of the time really were interested in having an answer for. And so over the generations, over the centuries, you finally got some monks who say, let's answer the king's question. Otherwise, we're going to lose support. And so they came up with the answer that there is no self. And that was the Buddha's teachings. And then they got themselves, you know, ever since then, 2,000 some years now, we've been entangled in what the Buddha called a tangle of views. What, there is no self, you know, who does the action, who receives the results of the action, how can rebirth happen, all these other things. All this tangle that the Buddha avoided by not answering the question. But anyway, what happened was the not-self teaching then becomes a no-self teaching and becomes a metaphysical teaching. This is the nature of reality. There is no self. Things are impermanent. Things are stressful. Things are not-self. This is the nature of reality out there. Nothing has any essence. And as a result, the three characteristics then become the context for the Four Noble Truths. They become the categorical teaching in the commentaries. At the same time, and the Four Noble Truths begin to morph. Clinging, in other words, instead of being what suffering is, suddenly becomes a cause for suffering. We cling to things because we believe that they're impermanent. We believe that they're permanent, not knowing that they are impermanent. Ignorance, which is another cause of suffering in addition to craving, comes from not seeing things in terms of the three characteristics. Now, originally, ignorance was not seeing things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. In other words, not remembering the guidelines for what actions are skillful and which ones are not. It simply now becomes a question of not remembering the true nature of reality out there. We're ignorant. We assume permanence in things that are impermanent. If people realize the truth of the three characteristics that was taught, they wouldn't cling and they wouldn't suffer. And this becomes the purpose of mindfulness practice, is just to see how impermanent things are and say, oh yeah, things arise and pass away. There's nothing there to hold on, so I just better let go. And finally, the picture of what happens in experience becomes a lot more passive. For the Buddha, he said, all your experience is rooted in desire. You're out there basically looking for trouble. You're looking for things to feed on, and you're looking sometimes with a lot of ignorance. But you're the active factor there. In the commentaries, experience becomes more passive. You know, the mind is there, kind of nice and calm, and then a sensory input comes and hits it, and then it reacts, rather than going out and looking for the input to begin with. So experience becomes a lot more passive in the commentaries. Now, this commentarial view is what has influenced modern Buddhism. And you see this in many, many books, even scholarly books. When they treat the Four Noble Truths, the discussion quickly morphs into a discussion of three characteristics. You know, we suffer. Why do we suffer? Because we think things are permanent, but if we knew things were impermanent, then we wouldn't suffer. Three Noble Truths suddenly become the context. And when they describe the Buddha's awakening, it's described as the Buddha seeing that things were impermanent, stressful, that there was no self. Even teachers, you know, the secular Buddhist teachers who reject the Four Noble Truths accept impermanence as a metaphysical truth that we have to hold to. Now, as a result of this, four misunderstandings come up that you find common in modern Buddhism. One is there is no self. That means there's no agent. There's nobody doing anything. And then it becomes the idea that people suffer because they think they can resist change. I once saw an explanation of the Four Noble Truths saying people suffer because they resist change. If they just would accept and embrace change, everything would be okay. Tell that to somebody who's in a concentration camp. Things change. You just embrace it, you'll be okay. That's not the issue. We do have agency, but we're taught that we have no agency in the new version of Buddhism. Second one is there is no such thing as long-term happiness. Pleasures and pains just come and go without you being able to extend the pleasures or shorten the pains. You just have to learn to accept that things are going to come, they're going to go. Thirdly, we're taught that to cling means to assume that things are impermanent. Excuse me, things are permanent. We hold on. However, if we could learn to hold on just briefly, realizing their impermanence, in other words, embrace things as they come and go. You've probably heard the image of the dancer dancing with lots of different partners. You leave this partner, you go on to the next partner, and you accept the fact that you're going to be changing partners all the time. Then you're okay. It doesn't count as clinging. The images that you often see about this, one, as I said, is the image of the dancer. Second one, very common one, is you're sitting on a beach watching the waves come in. And if you try to hold on to the nice waves and push the bad waves away, then you're going to suffer. But if you just accept the fact, waves are going to come and they're going to go, then you're going to be okay. There is no such, ultimately, there is no such thing as good or bad waves. It's just waves coming and going. And the fourth misunderstanding that comes up is that clinging means hold on to fixed views as to what is right and what is wrong. Now, in this case, you have to realize that when you just see things, the world is impermanent, things are stressful, there is no self. There's really no duties that are implicit in that. There's no way to say that you should do this or should not do this. People can react to impermanence in lots of different ways. Some people can say, well, it's impermanent, stressful, there is no self, let's go out and have a drink. And it would follow logically from those premises, right? And so this becomes, there is the Buddha's recommendations as to what should done and should not be done are then seen as results of his cultural background. You know, the Buddha lived in a different period. We live in a new period now. There are new ideas of what we should and shouldn't do. And that's perfectly fine because, after all, everything changes. Everything is impermanent. There are no right or wrong ways of interpreting the Dharma. Accept all change and you'll be fine. An example of this way of thinking is something I saw a while back. I was watching a TV show. They have a TV show on Buddhism in France once a week. In fact, I was there one time and the producers asked me, why don't you do this in America? After all, we have a lot more Buddhist teachers than they have, and they have trouble keeping new faces coming in. At any rate, there was a French Buddhologist on one day. He was talking about dependent core arising and impermanence, and the interviewer, a woman, asked him, so what does this mean in daily life? And he said, it means that if two people are in love, they have to accept the fact that their love today will be expressed in different ways than what it was expressed yesterday. Now, and I listened to that and I thought two things. One, that's a really French explanation of dependent core arising. And two, you can excuse a multitude of sins by saying, hey, my love today is different from yesterday. So it's irresponsible, is what it is. So what kind of views are they? As I said, one, they're defeatist. There is no true long-term happiness in life. You just learn how to accept things as they come and go. And you'll be, if you're peaceful about that and calm about that, then you'll be okay. Another person who was on the same show was advancing this idea. And the interviewer asked her, isn't this defeatist? Isn't this depressing and pessimistic? And she said, only if you think about it. So just don't think, you'll be okay. I could say, I think a lot of Vipassana courses are like that. Okay, it's defeatist, it's irresponsible. And secondly, is this really realistic? I mean, what do we cling to? Do we cling to things only thinking that are permanent? I mean, what are the things that most people cling to most fiercely? Food and sex, right? Any other candidates? Children, okay. Do you think they're permanent? Do we think food is permanent? Sex? Are children permanent? No. We know they're not permanent, but we cling anyhow, right? And that's why we suffer. We're doing it fully knowing that these things are not permanent. And we cling to them anyhow. Why do we cling? Because we think it's worth it. It has nothing to do whether they have innate nature or nothing or permanent nature or anything. It's, is it worth holding on? And we say, yes, with the pleasure we get from it is worth it. That's why we hold on. So basically what it is, it's a value judgment that we're making. We don't hold on to these things because we have a metaphysical view that they have essential essence. We hold on because we think, if I do this, if I act on this, if I hold on to this, I'm going to get enough pleasure that it's going to compensate for by holding on. But as human beings, we tend to be pretty bad judges of what's worth doing and what's not worth doing. There was a positive psychologist, you know, the type of psychologist who studies happiness. And he was... right? Okay. And he was interviewing people about what things that made them happy. And then he had this arrangement with them that he would call them up at random hours of the day, and if he happened to catch them when they were doing the thing that they were said was happy, and ask, "Are you happy?" And it turned out the answer was, "Well, not especially." But then if he asked him afterwards, "Were you happy then?" "Oh, yes, I was quite happy, you know, doing that." And he asked himself, "Why are people so foolish about their own happiness? Such bad judges of their own happiness." And then he thought about himself. He realized he liked to climb mountains. Now, but anything is not worth doing. It's just climbing a mountain for the sake of climbing a mountain and coming back down. And he realized while he was doing it, he was miserable. Cold, afraid of dying, whatever. But then he came back down. He couldn't wait to do it again. So this is the way we are. And so basically what the Buddha is doing in the Four Noble Truths is to give us better standards of judgment, better means of judgment, what really makes us happy and what doesn't, what we can do to gain happiness. So this analysis of, you know, it, taking the three characteristics as the nature of reality, and that's kind of the container for the Four Noble Truths, that's got everything backwards. Because it's teaching us views that are defeatist, irresponsible, and really not very realistic. They don't really describe reality as we behave. They don't describe clinging properly, they don't describe happiness properly. So let's go back and compare this again with the Buddha's teachings. For him, clinging, which he says constitutes suffering, is a type of feeding. We feed on things because, of course, we think we're going to get nourishment out of them. And this is not just physical food, but also emotional food, mental food. We're looking for the happiness we get out of holding on to these things. So that what this would mean in the Buddha's case, from the point of view of the Four Noble Truths, is this idea that simply embracing things in the moment, being willing to let go, we're serial clingers. And we do that, and we're going to suffer each time we cling and have to let go, cling and have to let go. There's no real happiness there, and there's no real peace in that. And so the Buddha's strategy in dealing with this problem is that we have to see the drawbacks of our feeding. I was talking about this yesterday during the course. Is there five stages to letting go of something you realize is unskillful? First is to see it come, and when it comes, what's coming with it? What's the cause? Secondly, when it goes, how does it go? Thirdly, what's the allure? Why do you like it? And this part is especially often hard for us to see clearly because we have some likes and that we tend to hide from ourselves. And then finally, seeing the drawbacks, that if you hold on to this, what actually happens? And if you actually see where the allure is and see what the drawbacks generally are, you will develop dispassion, and that's how you free yourself from that particular state of mind. So the three perceptions are applied to this comparing the drawbacks with the allure. Okay, this is what you think you get. This is what you actually get. Is it worth going for? And if you see that this is really what I'm getting for it is nothing I can really depend on, why go for it? If it's something stressful to hold on to, why go for it? And the judgment of not self is, okay, I let it go. As a result of following this, the Buddha says you can... To do this, however, you need an alternative source of food, and that's what the path provides. In the practice of virtue, you gain a sense of self-esteem. In the practice of concentration, you get a sense of visceral pleasure that is not a sensual pleasure. It's a pleasure that comes from, as we were working on earlier during the meditation, having a sense of having the breath flow smoothly through the body, having a sense of inhabiting a body that feels good to be inside. That gives you a pleasure that you can hold on to. Then as you begin to look at the other pleasures that you were going for, and you begin to see that they're not quite as good as you thought they were. The advantage of this is the Buddha says this eventually leads you to an experience of something that's totally unconditioned, which is deathless, and the three characteristics don't apply there at all. It's not inconstant, it's not stressful. Questions of self and not self no longer apply. The image the Buddha gives, instead of having you lying on the beach watching the waves come in, he says you're actually crossing over a river and you're going to be standing on firm ground where you are safe from the waves of the river. In this case, there's no quotation marks on good or bad waves. The waves of the river can sweep you away. You want to get past. When you get on ground, you don't have to worry about them. the advantage of this, the Buddha's approach, is that one, it gives you duties, not in the sense of duties imposed on you, but if you want to find happiness, the Buddha says, this is what you should do. If you could look at the three characteristics, there's no duties imposed. Things are inconstant, impermanent, you can do anything you want. Grab for whatever you can. But with the understanding that we suffer because we cling, because we crave and cling, but we can go past that. It's an action that we're doing that's not necessary. That gives you a sense of, there's a course in my life where I can start making choices based on the Four Noble Truths. So it gives them some guidance. It also gives you some focus on what kind of changes do you have to watch out for. If everything changes, everything is kind of equal. But in the context of the Four Noble Truths, one of the things that you have to watch out for, as the Buddha said, that one of the most changeable thing, well, the most changeable thing in the world is your own mind. He says the mind can change so quickly that there's no analogy that's adequate to express how quick it is. Even the blink of an eye is too slow. You've got to watch out for that. This is why we practice mindfulness, is to remember what guidance the Four Noble Truths give and the reasons why we should stick with that guidance. If we forget that, we can change at any moment. So this is the real role of mindfulness in the context of the Four Noble Truths, is to keep us from forgetting what the Buddha taught so that we can then apply it as we go through life. The second focus, of course, is on where are you looking for your happiness? Is it solid enough to support your happiness? That's the kind of change you have to watch out for. So the Buddha's seeing change in terms of the Four Noble Truths gives you some focus of where are the changes that you have to be careful about. It's the second kind of change where you've applied your hopes for happiness and placed them on something. This is where you have to develop your discernment. Mindfulness and discernment are the two big elements of the path. So this actually puts you in control. There's something you can do to gain long-term happiness rather than just having to accept the fact that things are going to come and go. Now, in terms of the views, it's interesting, that image of the raft. We very rarely think about, what does that river represent? And one of the things it represents, the Buddha says, is the flood of views, the views that would sweep you away. But the raft itself is composed of the elements of the Eightfold Path, which include right view. So right view is going to take you across other views. You get to the point ultimately where you don't need views. The purpose of right view is for you to look at your processes of holding on, and you apply that to all the other things that are unskillful that you've been holding on to. And finally, you take that same view and you turn it on itself. You say, even this process of holding on to right view has some stress built into it. Now, it's much less than the stress that comes from holding on to other things. But when you get to the point where that's the only stress left, you say, okay, now I can let go. And this is how right view transcends itself. So this kind of view is always responsible. It provides guidelines for what you should and shouldn't do. Gives you focus on where you should, what kind of changes you should watch out for. As I said, it contains the seeds for its own transcendence. And then you compare the type of happiness as possible. The first happiness, taking the three characteristics as your context, is, as I said, it's very defeatist. There's no longer term happiness, so satisfy yourself with little things as they come and go. However, the Buddha is not defeatist at all. I mean, the Buddha is anything but a defeated person. As he once said, the name for the path is unexcelled victory in battle. You're going out there and you're doing battle with your own stupidity. You want happiness, and you're doing things that are causing yourself misery. Now, that was Einstein's, almost, that's close to Einstein's definition of insanity, right? You're doing it again and again, you think you'll get a different result now. But that's what it comes down to. In fact, John Swett would use that word. It's because of our own stupidity. That's what the Buddha's battling, having us battle as well. So this seemingly pedantic point makes a big difference. And the question is, which do you want? The Buddha says an ultimate happiness is available. He's been teaching us swimming lessons to get to the other side for 2,600 years. And where are we? If you think about what this three characteristics Dharma does, it's actually siding with the advertising industry. It says, hey, look, total unchanging happiness is impossible, so content yourself with sitting on the shore. We'll bring you drinks and umbrellas. But don't count on us when a hurricane comes, okay? And the waves get big. So, the choice is yours. Those are my thoughts for the morning. Are there any questions? We have a few minutes before we have to break.
Hi. So I've personally found the Eightfold Path very helpful, and it feels like probably a lifelong pursuit to understand it and work with it. But I just have to be honest, and I've been maybe practicing for about 5 years. I don't really see any evidence that it's possible to get to the other side of this dream. And I'm actually okay with that. But I just, it's hard for me when people teach it because I don't believe it.
Well, what I say, John Mahabhua had a great statement one time. He said, you know, the people who have attained nirvana, if they could take it out and show it to you, that's all you would want. So it is possible. The question is, to what extent do you feel motivated that you're really going to say, I want this enough that I'm going to sacrifice other things for that? And even if you don't get there, think of it as something that gives you some hope. If you think, well, we just die, and then we're born, and then we die, and we eat. The Buddha's recollections of his previous lifetime, so he had this appearance, he had this name, he lived in this location, this was his food, this was his experience of happiness, this was his experience of pain, then he died. Birth, feeding, pleasure, pain, death. If you just think about that, is that all there is to human life? It gets very depressing. So remind us, okay, there is this possibility. And people have been finding it. People of all nationalities and genders and ages have found it in the past. So it's available. And at least that gives you some hope.
So could I just ask, when you find it, does it stay with you forever, or is it a thing that just continuously comes and goes?
No, it stays. It makes permanent changes. I was talking to a Zen teacher one time. He said, how can any change be permanent? I said, chop off your arm, you know. So it hits you, and, you know, once you've seen the deathless, he realized the Buddha really knew what he's talking about, and it ends your uncertainty about his teaching, about the Dharma. You also realize there was nothing that you would identify as you or yours in there, so you're not attached to any ideas about who you are. And then you realize it was through your own unskillful actions that you were blinding yourself to this dimension. So you never want to do anything unskillful again. It makes that kind of permanent change.
Thank you.
Has this happened to you?
I can't say. Because there's a rule against it.
Whose rule is it?
The Buddha's.
Who told you that?
It's in the text. Imagine all the monks who had...
forgive me.
Yeah. Imagine all the monks, if they had these attainments, everybody would be making merit with those monks, right? All the monks who had these attainments were saying, hey, here, I'm an arahant. Well, everybody would want to make merit with those monks. The other monks wouldn't get a chance to eat.
So,
in other words, I want to, you know, do the good that will lead to a good rebirth. And one of the things is, you know, you find somebody who's, you know, a highly attained person and you give something to them, and there's a lot of reward that comes from that. So the Buddha said, okay, nobody gets to tell the lay people who's attained and who's not.
So you can't tell us.
Will you repeat the question?
The question was, have I attained this yet? Okay, that was, she wanted to know. And I said, I can't answer that because the Buddha said not to answer that question.
So you can't tell lay people?
No. Can I tell monks? Yes, I can. I'll repeat a question. Can I tell monks? And yes, I can. But you have to be very discerning about that too. Okay, there's a mic back there. Who had the mic? Okay.
There's two mics. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for your talk about the three marks and the Four Noble Truths. I work a lot with the teaching of the eight worldly winds, and that seems like a teaching that says that it's not possible to escape pleasure, pain, and the eight worldly winds. Can you comment about maybe it's unskillful to work with that in the beginning, and it's something more towards the end, or
no,
trying
to understand? Those teachings are actually very useful for just everyday life. But realizing that these are the truths of the world as opposed to the truths of the practice. This is what the world has to offer. It has, you know, gain, loss, status, loss of status, praise, criticism, sensual pleasure, pain. That's it. And the purpose of this is I don't want my mind to get distracted by these things. So think of this in that category of things that you would apply the three perceptions to, so that you don't get waylaid from the path.
Is it a correct understanding of the sutta? Even I think it said even the Buddha experiences the eight-worldly ones.
Yeah, but he's not blown around by them.
Okay.
You know, the image they have is a stone column, you know, 16 spans tall, 8 spans buried in the rock. It's not going to move. And that's the mind that has gained awakening.
Buddha said to Ananda, I think the Sangha is the whole of the spiritual life.
No. He's an admirable friends.
Admirable friends.
And by the admirable friend, he meant himself. But then he went on to say, it's because of him that we know about that there's a path. Without him, we wouldn't even know that there was a path. Now, he can't do the path for us, but without him, we wouldn't know that there was a path. So in other words, it's a necessary but not a sufficient cause.
I'm puzzled. I thought there was an exchange where the Buddha's assistant or cousin said to him, I think the Sangha must be the half of
admirable friends are the half of the holy life. And by an admirable friend, someone who is generous, someone who has conviction, someone who is virtuous, someone who has wisdom. And then you associate with that person and you try to develop that person's qualities. Because without that example, you wouldn't know how to do it. But then in that particular sutta where Ananda is always, he's always the straight man. He says these things and the Buddha says, no. Like, dependent co-rising is so easy. No, it's not easy at all. Admirable friends are half of the holy life. The Buddha says, no, they're the whole of the holy life. But then his illustration is, okay, I am the admirable friend for everybody out there because I found the way. Without me, the Buddha said, no one else would know the way. So that's why we have to depend. That's how we depend on him. But we depend on him and we take him as an example and we try to develop those same qualities within ourselves. That becomes our refuge.
Okay. Because I was going to say then that it seems from what you were saying earlier in the talk that it's okay for us to lose wealth, our health, our relatives. So it just seemed strange to me that there was a valuing of Sangha and lesser value placed on family relationships.
No. It's your best friends are the admirable friends, i.e. people who are good examples. Now sometimes your members of your family are good examples and sometimes they're not, in which case if they're not, then you've got to look for a good example outside.
Yeah, but our children, I mean, we have to look after our children.
Okay, you have to be the admirable friend for your children now.
Right.
You've got to embody the good qualities. That's a whole another talk. Do we have to break?
Yes.
Do we have to break yet? How much time? Okay, I guess that's all for today. Thank you
Thank
for your
you.
Attention.